Hello world. You're listening to the Kitchener-Waterloo Linux User Group audio podcast. KWLUG discusses topics related to free and open source software of all kinds. We meet on the first non-holiday Monday of each month in Kitchener, Ontario, Canada. This podcast is released under a Creative Commons Attribution Share-alike license, so you can give it to others, remix it, or even sell it, provided you abide by the terms of the license and share alike the works that you remix and redistribute. For more information about KWLUG, visit kwlug.org. For more information about this podcast, visit kwlug.org/podcasts. In this month's meeting, Colin Knapp discusses his work with Oh My Forum, and Paul Niger discusses Big Blue Button.
Okay. So, for those of you who just joined in and may not necessarily recognize my voice, my name's Colin Knapp, and I'm the loose administrator and project manager and DevOps guy for Oh My Forum. And somewhere in this list on the far left, we have Michael Schramm, and I probably put an R in there. Yeah, Schramm. Sorry, that's the second time I've said his name. We actually met over voice for the first time today over Discord, and we've been corresponding through our Discord server for the last year, and mostly GitHub issues back and forth. And we basically both had a mutual need for a self-hosted form software, not forum like Discord, Discourse or Zenforo, but Typeform/Google Forms, Telforms, any of those that would be self-hostable and not an absolute pain in the neck to do so. So for me, that's, you know, a nice portable Docker container manages to fit that bill pretty well. So my initial thing was I found a form software that was out there in the wild called Telform, which I had inadvertently adopted. And 6 months after basically kind of trying to keep that project somewhat relatively alive, despite its many shortcomings at the time, Michael Schramm decided to pop up out of nowhere. And him being much more adept at JavaScript, managed to help me with my DevOps skills for Docker, stitch together something relatively useful and functional. And you could actually boot it for once. For the first time in over a year, Telform could be installed on something. And at that point, we'd realized how many holes there were in the code and the functionality. And we were going to try and spin up our own official Telform repository on Docker Hub under the Telform brand, since I'd been essentially gifted the entire brand. But the original developer was rather difficult to get in touch with on a regular basis, so I tried to do my demand that lean. But it was a fairly popular project that had 2,500 stars on GitHub, which is, as you know, relatively high for developer engagements on GitHub, I'm sure, if you have any experience with GitHub. Anyways, long story short, we decided that maybe waiting for the sparse interactions back and forth while we have our intermittent availability and inspiration, that maybe we should just start our own brand, and thus Oh My Forum was born from the ashes of Telform. So we got it working, we got it Dockerized, and then we basically deprecated it and then redirected everyone over to Oh My Forum. And with absolutely no proper marketing campaign or anything of that sort, we managed to get on average at least 100, somewhere between 50 and 100 hits on the website every day since, and it's just been growing. And it's all just like open source people just desperately wanting this software. And And we keep getting these messages on Discord and in the GitHub issues saying, hey, so this stuff, it works and it installs good, like, well, and, you know, it's all pretty and stuff, but there's a few holes in it. Can you guys patch it? And we're like, yep, we're getting around to it. We're getting around to it. We swear. That's a thing. And then Michael ended up getting a senior position at a development firm in Berlin. And I'm sitting here thinking, oh boy, we may never actually get this product off the ground. And 6 to 8 months of me being extraordinarily patient and Michael reassuring me over and over, and I'm sure I was driving him nuts that he was going to get around to helping out finish his rewrite PR number 40 on GitHub, if you want to be impressed with the amount of work that he had to put in. 2 weeks ago, he decided that he was going to spend a lot of time, and even last night was up till 4 in the morning, his time, stitching this together so that we could do a talk, and thusly basically invalidating most of my talk from yesterday that I had already mostly kind of planned out based off of the kind of whole, like, stodgy code base from before. You can currently see the live demo of the previous code base. I haven't updated it to the new code base yet. So let me post that into the chat here. And feel free to log in. It's high security for the guest user. There's a whole bunch of stuff. That's the username, and that's the password. Feel free to log in and take a look. Poke around and see how so many of the features don't quite work. But it's still quite nice. Like, the interface was beautiful, but it's written in Angular. Which is, I guess, fairly dated at this point. We have diverged almost entirely from this code base now, except for our version is a drop-in replacement. So the back end, the Mongo database, which somebody raised in a Git issue recently, that MongoDB is in fact has a really terrible license. So we're going to try and find a different way eventually, and that's on the agenda. But anyways, you can basically drop our version in, which brings me to what I can show you if I can manage to get it redirected. Yes, thank you. If I can get this tab redirected to the correct thing here. Maybe I'll just do the whole application window, because then I don't have to determine, discern which the tab is that I'm sharing. So there are obvious caveats. Like, if you go to log in and you log in with my test user, obviously you can't go to my localhost :5000 and log in, because that won't be on your machine, at least not yet, unless you have Docker, and then you can follow along in a few minutes. This is a caveat here that's, you know, this is a 2-week project right now, so you can't see that you're logged in anywhere, but you can answer questions in a form. So in this case, if I refresh this form, it'll pick up my cookies, and this is my basic little form. So welcome, this is our landing page. Welcome to our OMI form we just created. Please take some time to answer the most important question of all. What is the meaning of life, the universe, and everything? Well, 42, hit enter. And that's it. That's basically what our 2 weeks took to do. It's wonderful. It's very simple. There's a few things that currently don't work. This is the reason why we haven't merged it into the master branch over on the original code base, which looks more like this. And these are different forms that people have created. So here's one here. So you can click start. The interface's definition is a little funny. It doesn't really show up very well. The hotkeys work mostly. You can tab through things, you can untab through things, and it'll do all this wonderful, beautiful, like, scrolling. And you can answer your questions here. You hit enter a few times, and then it brings you to the finishing page. And then if you go back to the administration side, I believe if I refresh, there should be, I'm guessing it's this one that I just answered first. So you can see that none of the metrics were showing up, and that we have a number of different answers to our questions here. You should be able to export it. This is not a thing that this version does, and it's also not a thing that our version does as of yet. So if you refresh this page, you'll see that I'm not able to log in because I was logged in as the user potato. So I'm going to click admin. Hopefully, see, this is a problem. This is new. Oh yes. So there's no log out at the moment. You just log in again, and then you can refresh your cookies by, in my case, pressing Command R, or in your case, probably F5. And you'll be able to click on the admin panel, and you'll see here your form that we just filled out. So you can see show submissions, and so far, three people have answered. Two people have abandoned, I guess. I'm not entirely sure what these do just yet. Maybe Michael can pipe up and it kind of explain it, but it seems like most people get that the correct answer is 42, so far, seeing as they're all me. Anyways, so that's basically the quick technical demo or non-technical demo. Give me a second to stop my screen share, go back to some stuff here. If anybody has any questions or wants to me to showcase anything that I kind of quickly skimmed over, the red cross showing up in this case, the form has not been continued for more than 30 minutes, assumed abandoned. Oh, that's a good assumption to make. Share my screen. Did you need me to refresh my screen share? I just canceled it 2 seconds ago. Yeah, I've only got one monitor, so it's quite difficult for me to read chat at the same time. Was it like that for everybody? I hope not. It's like that for me now.
Is this the open source version of something like SurveyMonkey or other things like that?
So SurveyMonkey is a little bit different, but yes, essentially. If you have you heard of an alternative to SurveyMonkey called Typeform?
It doesn't ring any bells.
Okay, so Typeform is its main like deal is that basically it's a survey software that you can type hotkeys to kind of mash through. It's also mobile forward in design, so it generally targets more towards people who are obviously on their cell phones or tablets, or smaller screen devices. It seems like the world is trending towards no longer using PCs as their predominant access to the internet these days, so it's important to focus forward on the big big target. Oh, good, fair enough. That then I'll pay attention to the chat. I'm fine if people wanted to unmute. Like the thing too is like I was going to say if Michael wanted to chime in at any point, he would be able to. Lime Survey is a good option. I haven't used it personally. But basically, it's just one of the biggest goals for me is that I wanted to be able to replace Google Forms. And seeing as there was no reasonable open source software that didn't have to install like an entire WordPress instance or other CMS of some sort just to get this application pulled out of it and into the real world, I had to keep digging until I found something. And I thought, I always had a good experience with Typeform, but Typeform requires that you pay, and it has a lot of ads and other various details like that. And I'm just not really keen on having my users get spammed with a bunch of questions. Plus, I didn't want to just feed all of my data into yet another data silo, such as Google. Google does work relatively well for us on a different project. So, like, for example, one of the functions that you'll be able to do with Oh My Form's latest version is we have it built such that you can have webhooks. So once a question or a form has been submitted, like it's the answers have been submitted, you'll be able to tell Oh My Form, hook into my Slack channel and send the answers, or say, I don't know. I mean, what else would you do with webhooks? I mean, I basically funnel it into my Discord channel. That's a big one. Let's say you wanted to have a recruitment campaign, you could have a Q&A in an Oh My form, and then those answers could be dropped into your recruitment chat that's private to you and your administration. That would be another potential good use for this software.
Remains stored on inside the Docker container, I guess, or what is the data format?
Yes. So the container cluster is defined by a Docker Compose. I tried to stick with relatively sane defaults for Docker. So volumes everywhere where the persistent data should be, so that you never actually blow away any of your data when you reinstall stuff. So right here, for example, if you look at the Docker Compose, I'm sharing, correct? Okay, good. If you look at the Docker Compose here on line 9, you have it bound to your current working directory /data/Mongo, and then it mounts inside of the Mongo database directory. We eventually want to change this image, but that's kind of going off from your question. So it's stored in Mongo in JSON format. Eventually, we're going to have an exporter. It's on the agenda. We're going to be exporting in primarily CSV. And then if anybody wants to subscribe to the Open Collective, which is our funding solution, where it's fully transparent and basically developers who contribute can send our Open Collective an invoice, and then me or Michael can hit pay from any donations that we receive. But basically, if you wanted to be able to, for example, export to, you know, the enemy over at Google Docs, you could have that, and somebody would be able to send us money through the Open Collective, and then thusly somebody would pick up that task and submit it back to the repository, and we would consider merging it into the official code base. And that way we can create open source jobs for contributors, if of course anybody ever actually does subscribe to the Open Collective. We'll see if that happens. I don't know, maybe it's a bit of an experiment, but does that answer your question relatively aptly?
It was more the data format, let's say the format inside Mongo. Like the different questions have different types, or what does it look like? How would it be shared with other systems?
So at the moment, the high level answer to this I can give, and the low level I'll let Michael do, potentially in chat if he's not feeling up to voice, is basically we have an API separated now out of the monolithic app that used to exist, where such that you'll be able to use GraphQL to pull the data in a JSON sort of like response. The app itself, it basically aggregates that data to you. The types wise, I think that's a question that I'll have Michael answer more specifically.
So just to go into the details of how the data itself is structured. So in MongoDB, we have basically a document collection for the forms. And within that collection, there's a subdocument for each field within the form. When a submission is made, this is fed into a separate collection, where basically every field is referenced for each entry that is added by the user. And this is basically the structure that we took over from Telform. So we have it 100% compatible after we do the update, so no one actually has to migrate anything and it's just working again.
Nice, thank you.
So I'm going to point out our lovely installer. It's quite basically future-proof because I won't even have to really rewrite it for this new code base because it's literally just all in Docker containers. However, you will need to get the latest Docker compose.yml if you wanted to try ours from the next branch on GitHub. But if you go to http://omyform, you can go here and check out the documentation. You can see our old installer video. This is something we have to update, or our old our old GIF demo. But anyways, here's our quick start Docker and the environment variables and configuration. So right now you can define all of these either in your Docker compose, and these are your settings for the application. Or you can, I believe there's a config file, if I'm not mistaken, that Michael is going to support as well. But if you navigate back, oh, go ahead.
In theory, you can provide a .env file, which is just a shortcut for environment variables. But I think in general, it's easier or better to use if the environment variables are passed. And in addition to the configuration that we have through the environment variables, is that we intend to have the settings also on the database side, which has the added benefit that as of then, the user would be able to change all of the configuration also through the web interface.
I much prefer that actually long term. I think in the beginning, realistically, all you should really have user facing would be the just the database configuration settings, and then after that, everything else should be defined in the database. That's excellent. The other thing too is we also added a Redis server, and you were saying that that was for allowing for full scalability. So one of the things that you could theoretically deploy to would be a Docker swarm. With scalable front ends and the same Mongo back end and Redis back end, and it should technically work at this point already. Is that correct?
Exactly. And the reason for this is that, I mean, I don't know if we've already mentioned it, the communication between the API, which is connected to MongoDB, and the front end itself is done through GraphQL. And with GraphQL, we have subscriptions and we'll at other WebSocket connections, and therefore those need to know from which system they're being sent out. And we do not know when it's a load balanced environment and which environment actually a request is coming in. So the whole code base for the next version is already prepared to run in a load balanced environment for people that actually scale OmyForm to this level.
And now you'll actually have an excuse to do so because the application is relatively stable at this point. I mean, the other one I've left running on the demo container for months, and you can see all the test forms that people have done. I'm actually surprised nobody's like defaced the forms by putting in a bunch of obnoxious stuff. So sometimes you can leave things just kind of plugged into the internet and seems like nobody's going to mess with it by default, which is surprising to me. But good to see. In the future, we're going to be pulling automatically whenever a new container gets pushed and re-updating the demo instance. But feel free to beat up the old one for as long as you like today. We're going to be replacing it relatively soon, I imagine, in the next week or two, whenever we manage to tick off a few more of our to-do list items, which I can go over in a few minutes. But so far, this is the install. Tutorial, five steps and you're basically ready to go. In this current version where we have it based in a fork, so if you check out here, you see that it's in, or not a fork, a branch, you see that it's sitting under next, and there's new code here, and it's actually relicensed under a GPL v3, so it's to kind of be more FOSS forward. You'll be able to do, like, I think it's like git checkout, and I think it's just not TACB. I think you do TACB if you're going to do a new command, but it's git checkout next, and then you'll be able to do Docker compose up from inside of the directory. That's the only difference. And of course, obviously, you'll end up having to modify your Docker compose in whatever way suits your current environment. There is an example currently online using traffic as a reverse proxy. If you own your domain and you're internet facing, the routing should be relatively simple. And it'll do Let's Encrypt automatically for you and all that other fun. But first I'll play this console playback for us all so that we can kind of see what this looks like in deployment or on an actual server. The beauty of this recording software that I used, not being that I can zoom in, so sorry if it's not very big for you. You're welcome to watch it on your own machine this way. But is that it's a console playback. It's not an actual video. So you can highlight the text at any point. So say my documentation doesn't quite match up with the actual reality of the situation, you can copy my working commands directly out and maybe update my Git repositories with an issue saying, hey, fix this. So it's there it is pulling the Git clone. Now we move into the directory, Docker compose up D. You can see that it's pulled a mail container, which that's mail hog. You're obviously going to want to replace that with an actual mail server that will actually send mail instead of just showing you what would have happened. Then you can, you'll see that it's pulled up Redis, MongoDB, and Mongo Express. So you can actually look at the database here. This is all publicly facing on the demo instance as well. I know that's dangerous, of course, as well, but everything is ephemeral on the demo instance. I just have to read launch and it gets started again. So I will link in the chat the URLs for this and the actual public instance so that the group can have a look in a minute. But yeah, that's essentially how long it takes to get OMIFORM installed on a Docker machine. It's relatively easy. So long as you have Docker installed, you're good to go. It's just looping now. But at the end of the day, you've got, it automatically publishes on port 5000, which is something you'll see here. You can change this if you feel like you need to. In a traffic reverse proxy or HA proxy setup, you wouldn't expose these ports. You would route them internally inside of the Docker networking. Pardon me. You can see that it depends on other things, but anyway. So in my case, it's like localhost colon 5050 takes me to the mail hog 5051. Takes me to the Mongo Express. So I think if I recall correctly, monitor omiform.com. This will take me to the traffic reverse proxy. No, it doesn't. Maybe this. Perhaps this. Yes, there we are. So this is what Mongo or omiform would look like routed through routed through traffic reverse proxy. So you'll see Matomo compose. So we've got metrics collection going. We're going to be leaving those, I believe, on by default, but you'll be able to turn it off in a setting using an environment variable. Just for the beginning, we may decide to just ship it off. It's difficult to tell what we would decide to do long term. I know that there's a number of privacy nuts, including myself, who cringe at the thought of leaving it on by default. I know. I'm definitely one of those people, but I definitely understand the need for wanting to know that this stuff is relevant. So we shall see. I don't know. Maybe if enough people throw shade at me in a GitHub issue, then we can turn it off. So here's the link to the MailHog if you wanted to test and play. Here is the link to the Mongo Express. No, that's not it. Here it is. And again, this is using the old demo, but you can see the schema right there. So this will be useful for you, Chris, if you wanted to have a look at the data set itself. Now, eventually we want to plan on having Droplet installs. You said, or Michael was saying, you wanted to have a Terraform template, I think is the nomenclature, templates, I don't know. Install function thing developed for Terraform. I know a few people have been wanting Heroku as well. So Heroku was something that Terraform it supported by default already. Again, this is relatively kind of like unstructured because of, you know, having completed this morning. So if anybody has any questions else, otherwise, I'm definitely open to more questions. Feel free to interrupt me as I'm kind of filling space, poking through my tabs here on more stuff to talk about. Has anybody, like, go ahead.
The first version was Angular. What about the second one? Is it Angular 2 or is it Vue?
So we were going to do Vue, but then Michael has, he had some really good points.
I mean, initially the intent, as just mentioned, was to build everything with Vue and to build that on top of Next.js. But for me, since I was working the last year purely with React and the React ecosystem, I decided very shortly to go on the React side. And with React, we're also using, for example, a UI framework called ArtDesign. And ArtDesign has the best support for React. I mean, there are wrappers, for example, for Vue.js and Angular as well. And as a base framework for the front end, Next.js, which has the added benefit that it provides server-side rendering as well as the complete routing, so we don't have to take care of that, and we can focus mainly on the business logic of providing usable forms.
Yeah, makes sense. Server-side rendering is like perfect. It removes every question.
Yeah. And it's actually tricky to do that from the ground up yourself. I mean, this is possible and can be done, but at a time when there are good frameworks for especially React and Vue, it's way easier to use one of those and simply go with the flow. One reason why we did not go with Vue is that we wanted to build the whole new platform on a typed or semi-typed language, which was TypeScript. And Vue still has only limited support with TypeScript.
So then the question is, when you make a form, will you be able to generate also definition files, which can be later on used by somebody who consumes this data?
What do you actually mean by definition files? The form itself or the form fields are all defined in separate TypeScript files. And basically every form field has its own component. And each of those components is then rendered once on the server side when it's being loaded and then filled with data on the client side.
No, I mean when I consume data from the MongoDB. Or is there like, maybe it's a trivial question, like there's a GraphQL for it?
Okay, I think I know what you mean. We have basically basic information for every form field that's common for every form field, which is, for example, if the form field is required, what type this form field is, what's the title, what's the description, and so on, as well as logic jumps between or conditions for fields. And then on top of that, we have for specific form fields settings for each field. And those settings are actually is a list of key value pairs where any data can be written to. And the value is actually stored on the MongoDB side, simple as JSON, and is also transferred through GraphQL as a string that contains JSON. The reason why this is transferred as a string that contains JSON is because with GraphQL, you have to type every field that you send. And we don't want to have in the API the strict definition of what settings we support for form fields.
Okay, thank you.
So I'm jumping back and forth, looking at my Etherpad that I'd posted. Just to point out, now that we have a relatively reasonable version 0.9.0, we are looking for contributors. So if anybody is interested or inspired on some ground level stuff, there is some development MD that we got started. And of course, Git issues, feel free to have a peruse. I've posted links to the installation throughout. We've discussed the critical kind of technical decisions. There we are. So there's that. Dependencies, we've kind of brushed over those. I'm going to talk about the milestones before we hit version 1.0 officially and merge, which should probably happen maybe, I'd imagine, within a month. Potentially, Michael, I'm not sure what you're feeling.
I hope so.
Okay. until then, anybody who's willing to switch a GitHub branch or a Git branch would be encouraged to get the preview. It's already relatively stable database-wise, and we're not planning on breaking the schema. So you'll be able to pull it in now and play with it as much as you like, or deploy it anywhere you like. But there is a couple of caveats, such as that we have issues with the drop downs and the radios options. So for questions, those won't work. We're looking to make this a fully localizable appliance, seeing as a lot of our tracking metrics point out that we get a lot of traffic from India, Brazil, and China. So I think Michael's got someone who's already going to be working on the simplified Chinese. Is that correct?
We have the open pull request in the main repo, and try to port this and try to get in contact with the guy so we update it for the current version.
Okay. Then there is... we have to add more email templates, and you're going to be using mjml.io for our markup language for email, I suppose, in the application by default, which makes it responsive on different devices. So you'll have it viewable relatively well on a PC, just as much as you would on a Mac, Linux, or Android or iOS device. Of course, we covered syncing the data. Our goal will be exporting it to an CSV, so that's the most universal thing that seems to exist. We want to have webhooks enabled in the user interface. Recordings and installation updates we need to do for our documentation. Matomo integration, we want to, of course, have our tracking token in there. And we want to let you have your tracking token in there. I'm not exactly certain that we're going to be supporting Google Analytics anytime soon, but of course, that's a, a bounty somebody could post if they wanted. Beauty of open source and all. Then I guess at this point, if anyone else has any further questions, other than that, I guess I could kind of like elaborate on any of my motivations as to why we went this route and what our kind of goals are going to be in the future, more long term. I see Bob texting or typing. Well, I have this addiction to self-hosted things to begin with, and I, as I mentioned in my with my one organization, I have lots of Google Docs or Google Forms that automatically ping our administrative secret channels where we keep all the NDA stuff. And some of the NDA stuff includes your application to work for my company, for example, if you wanted to do that. And you would upload like your PDF for, you know, your resume and all that things and such. And then it would be passed via a webhook into our chat software. And once you hit the submit button. So that's something that I currently use forms for. And maybe you want to go on a family holiday with 30 other friends and family, like my stepmother does. And maybe we wanted to gather everybody's opinion so we could force everyone in the family to sign up for Oh My Form, our own instance, and not have to tell Google where we're going to go. Maybe we have some dissidents in our family who just don't want to necessarily get scooped because Google like ratted us out to the NSA or whatever, you know. Let's see. I know. Well, we actually do typically do have a one time of the year family vacation where there's a whole bunch of friends and family and anyone who wants to go. But yes, that, you know, two real world scenarios. Hopefully that's enough for you. Now, one of the biggest things that I was really frustrated with the internet over the last decade is just the complete lack of accessibility. So we're going to be focusing on WCAG 2.0 A+ or AA or above, which is now the legal requirement for organizations in Canada and the United States. And I think in the EU, it's WCAG 2.0 AAA rating or higher. So we wanted to support that by default. I know that Michael wants to have encrypted database entries such that I guess it might be applicable to HIPAA compliance and things. Go ahead, Michael.
Was in this case a simple yes.
Okay, fair enough. Yes, so web content accessibility guidelines. So like no all capital letters headers that are going to yell every individual letter to a person who has optics issues. they'll have their reader actually read like a title. So like if you're like, let's say you have to have a reader, that word would be read READER, and it would be read really quickly. So a WCAG version of that header would actually show the like to a person that in capital letters, but it would have, I think it's like a meta tag or something. I think somebody here, yeah, exactly. Somebody here will be able to tell you this specific tag name or the nomenclature for it, but it would actually read like that to the screen reader rather than. And another thing is like alt text, for example, on imagery. So there hopefully at some point should be some functionality where we'll be able to add alt text to an image if we allow people to upload images to their forms, such that somebody who can't see what's in the image would be able to get a descriptive text next to it. other accessibility stuff, such as like no animations automatically for, I think it's more than three plays throughs before it's automatically paused. Just a bunch of like silly usability things that you normally wouldn't think about as a regular able-bodied person, but makes this software significantly more accessible to other individuals. Contrast limits between text, and you'll notice that the suggested themes. So if we go to admin here, okay, I have to log in first. So root, and then I go to admin. Come on, maybe I must refresh. Here we go. So if you go here and go to forms and you edit your form, you'll be able to change the designs. So you can change the different colors, and we've chosen a bunch of WCAG colors.
I don't know if all I can see is the spinny circles. I don't know if everybody else can see that. But...
Okay.
No, I can see correctly.
Okay. I'll refresh it just in case.
Andrew, I had the same. I went out and came back in. On the Firefox.
There you go. So, and now is that working for most people now? Anybody who wants to see can see?
Oh, now it's not working for me. I'll restart maybe.
Okay. I've restarted my stream side three or four times while we were discussing it. So I'm just using a Brave browser. A lot of people don't like how it shills crypto and that it's not really private, but it's like marginally better than just default Chrome. So that's why I use it. I'm migrating back to Firefox for the third time in my life. Okay. You can see that there's a number of colors that we've already chosen here on the right. I'm not sure what the inspiration was with these specific colors, but I imagine it had something to do with the WCAG guidelines and contrast requirements. And then it shows you like what white would look like over here. I could pull up this form, for example. Let me turn this, go back up to the, oh no, that's the wrong form. Let me get to the form itself so that we have it. There's the link. Okay, so if we edit this, change, let's say, the background of the active color, the foreground of the active color to red, I hit save, you'll see on the form, if you hit tab, you hover your mouse over the text or the button and it changes color. So you can change the hover text color, and that works. So now I get back. One of the things that we want to do is we want to suggest palettes because copying and pasting color codes can be arduous, especially if you're making a number of forms. So we want to add that. Something that we don't have currently. We also want to suggest a number of default ones that are WCAG approved in the interface. You can set self notifications. You can set respondent notifications. You can change your start page and your end page. So the things that you see before and after. I'm imagining at some point we're going to maybe perhaps not have a loop back button logic there in case we only want one person answering once, things like that. Self notifications, if you just want to just have your own email get spammed every single time, or you have an administrator who needs to get these answers, you can pull the form offline or online. Currently, I believe there's English and German. I guess DE is the language code for German. Here's the actual form builder. So you can add any number of things. So you can add a date, an email, a text area, link, drop down, reading, and a radio button. And you can add above and below each entry. So like we can add one below, say, I don't know, anyways. And this time you could require the question be answered rather than, or maybe not require it, for example. And then you can save and add. Another question that you could add would be, say, the date. No, that's not what I clicked. There. So, oops, wrong thing. And email, so that we know that we can email you on the day that you picked, so we can make fun of your answers. Say you wanted to send us a link, you could do a URL. So then you can save. Go back to the main page again and go here. And now I've got a tabbable. You can tab through check inputs. Oh, apparently not. So there's a couple. Oh, there we go. What day do you want? Okay, we'll pick a day. We'll pick the 4th. So the one thing that I like about Typeform that we don't have yet is we don't have hotkeys highlighted in the interface over the buttons. So I'm thinking that's something that we'll probably be adding soon. There we go. Thank you for filling out the form. And if you click this button, it takes you right back up. You re-enter the stuff. Oh no, I just realized that it was doing that all in a whole new browser and or browser tab and nobody could see that at all. I'm sorry. And nobody said anything in voice, so I didn't know. Oh boy. All right. I'm good to go. I'm done. That's my form. Thank you for your time and attention and feel free to check out the next branch and give that a play. Sorry I didn't show you any of the forms in front of you in the actual tab. I feel a little silly, but that's okay. Wouldn't be the first time.
No, that was awesome, Colin. This was your inaugural KWLUG virtual presentation. You did very well. I will make sure that I go back and pick up all the links. And drop them in the mail in the meeting notice on the website, and I will try to put everything I can into the mailing list as well. And that's it, I guess. So if people want to follow up, it's the Open Collective or the GitHub repository. Sounds like they're the two places to see if they want to contribute. Is that right?
That would be perfect. Yep. Basically, just go check out the website. We're going to be doing our best to drive out a nice 1.0 official release in the next couple of months. It's been a while, but I'm glad that we kept at it, and I think it's going to be a useful and hopefully valuable asset to the world. Thank you, everybody, for listening.
Okay.
Sounds good to me.
This presentation is very, you know, mid-2010s kind of slides oriented. There's a couple of reasons for that. Instead of doing nice demos and stuff like that, first of all, the demos would be kind of boring. And second of all, I guess we are all looking at the demo because this is, in fact, Big Blue Button. So I have a bunch of slides, maybe too many slides, but I'm going to give mostly a broad overview as opposed to a very deep dive into the configuration and code. But if you have questions about that, you can ask, and then maybe I'll see if I have enough bandwidth to actually share my screen. I have a feeling I don't. My internet is not that good here. So let's get started. Let's get started with the usual way I start presentations, which is a story. So here's a story. Oh no, we're in a pandemic, you may have noticed. And then we're told, hey, everybody stay home, but you should continue to hold meetings somehow. And so everybody else in the world just went with Zoom. And I was like some privacy zealot and something. And I was like, oh, do I trust Zoom? Should we put our data on Zoom? Maybe there's bad things about Zoom. But everybody else was fine with Zoom. I was stubborn, though. So I said, well, maybe we can just use something that's something else, something that's self-hosted. The other big problem with Zoom, of course, is that if you don't pay Zoom, then you're limited to 40-minute meetings. And then, like, how can you decide whether this button should be purple or pink? You need much more than 40 minutes in order to do those kinds of meetings. And therefore, Zoom might not have been the best solution. So I'm pretty sure that lots of us have this kind of problem. Another thing is there's this meetup group called KWLUG, and they're all a bunch of privacy and open source zealots, but we weren't going to be able to have our presentations, and we'd break our like 18 and a half year streak or something. I don't think we've actually had an 18 and a half year streak, but we don't tend to miss many presentations. And so are we going to have to give that up because we don't have a way to present? Or can we find another solution? If we find another solution, does it have to be Zoom or some other awful presentation? Or can we do something that's more FLOSS friendly? So that let me down a great big rabbit hole of trying to figure out what we could do to actually do our presentations online in this awful new world that we've somehow ended up in. The darkest timeline. So, what could we do? Well, I happen to remember back in August 2011, Raul actually demonstrated a web conferencing system called Big Blue Button, and it was pretty slick. And so I looked at that presentation and I was super impressed, and then I forgot about it for about 9 years. And now it's 9 years later, and I suddenly remember this presentation when thinking about what web conferencing options to do. So this was one of the ones that I tried. We basically looked at this one in Jitsi, and this one was looking pretty good. It looked like it had a nice interface. It was free and open source software, and we could host it on our own server. So maybe we could set it up. That was the idea. And then we said, whoops, how hard could that be? And this is always the question that gets me into enormous amounts of trouble, and then I have to do presentations about them. Okay. So what is a Big Blue Button? Well, that's kind of what we're looking at now, but let me give you a little bit of background context. It's online classroom software. So the intended use case is to have sort of seminars for little runny-nosed snot monsters. The idea is that everything should be really, really easy to use. So the name comes from it should be as easy to use as pressing a big blue button, as opposed to the big red button, which we are not allowed to press. So those are the kind of goals. It's not really supposed to be like a Zoom replacement or a group chat replacement, but as it turns out, it works pretty well for that. And it's got lots of other kinds of use cases, but they are strictly focused on online classrooms. And their goal is, almost at the expense of everything else, make the interface really nice and easy to use. Some history. Here's some history I didn't even know. It's Canadian. It's kind of Canadian. It started at Carleton University, and it was their platform that they were developing for distance learning. And then in 2009, everybody was open sourcing everything, and so they open sourced everything, and they released it under the LGPDL. Then they spun up a few companies to do support and hosting, and that's how they were going to pay for it. Is that working? Well, one of the companies is called Blindside Networks, and I think that they're still in business. And then there's a few other companies, like there's one in Brazil called MCOMP and a few others that are actually able to do support and hosting for it. So if you have a Big Blue Button server, they can take care of it for you, or they can host your stuff for you. One of the things that's kind of interesting about this is that unlike many of the new projects that are out there, which are like, we're a nice corporate company that's going to make $1 billion, but we need advertising, so the way we're going to advertise is we're going to release a community edition or open core, and then all of the good stuff is going to be hidden behind proprietary software. This is really trying to be completely open source. Like, everything that they do is kind of released. And
they actually, and furthermore, not only is it released in terms of the code, but they actually provide instructions on and scripts for how you can actually install it yourself, as opposed to, this is too complicated to compile and install. Here's a pre-compiled Docker image at best, or just trust us, it's fine. Adoption, so there's an API which is really helpful so other projects can integrate into it. Some interesting projects, Moodle is one of the first integrations I had heard about. There's this thing called Canvas, a learning management system, which I don't really know much about, but it seems to be the main proponent of Big Blue Button in terms of learning software. Desire to Learn has this thing, I think it's Bongo actually, and its virtual classroom is actually Big Blue Button under the hood. And then you can actually integrate it into like different CMSs and stuff like that. So under the hood, what is actually going on? It's actually a bunch of different projects all kind of smushed together to work. And so the audio is VoIP software. It's FreeSwitch. If you've heard of Asterisk, FreeSwitch is kind of a competitor or successor to that. Webcams and screen sharing, there's I think it's mostly Corento. I don't even know what Corento is really, although you see mentions of it, but that I think is the thing that's streaming out webcams and screen displays to everybody. There's an HTML5 client, that's what you're looking at right now. It used to be written in Flash, but now it's written in HTML, and that's using Meteor.js. Presentation upload, so these slides, or you can take a document or a slide or something, and then you can upload it, and then LibreOffice is running behind in the background in some Tomcat window, and it converts the thing for you and actually makes it so you can display it. The shared notes are done with Etherpad. The backend, I don't know, it's like Scala or Java or some JVM thing. I haven't actually looked at it too much. And then the thing that you type in for the code, the access code that I screwed up and was completely wrong so that you could actually get in, that's a front end. And that front end is written on Ruby on Rails, and that's called Greenlight. So there's actually more stuff going on under the hood, but basically their idea is they're going to take different components, smush them together, and then make a web conferencing system out of that. Okay, so let's say that you want to set things up. What do you do? Well, you can just go to test.bigbluebutton.org, and then you can have a demo. And so that's one way to do it. Or we have this server that you can always test out if you want to do a demo, or you have a user group or something like that, or you want to have a movie viewing party, then we can do that as well. Test.bigbluebutton.org is what you can send to your friends, though, and then it allows you to just create a room and try out the features. And that's the way that I started, and then I looked at it in 2020, and it looked like, oh, wow, that actually looks pretty good. Hardware. In terms of hardware, it's kind of picky, and this is actually one of the ways that we got burned. So Big Blue Button really wants a bare metal install, and the reason it wants it is because of the audio processing with FreeSwitch. So if you put this in a virtual machine on some container host that has 12 other virtual machines and they're all fighting for CPU, then you lose some of the real-time latency stuff, and then your audio doesn't sound so good. So if you have that kind of hardware, either a server or like a desktop, it works really good. If you're wanting to put it on the cloud, you can put it on the cloud, and it kind of works. There's a bunch of people who do it with AWS. I didn't try to put it on a Linode or something like that. You might be able to work, but I think that the danger that you're going to run into is bad audio quality. What they want is their minimum requirements is 8 gigs of RAM with 4 CPU cores. And then here's another big limitation. They actually want a big fat pipe. So they're talking about 250 megabit internet, both in and out. And there's even places that I was reading that suggest a gigabit in and out for your server. And it turns out that on our other server, the meetings, the workingcenter.org one, we didn't have that because we were behind a Rogers connection and we only had 20 meg up. And then that turned out to kill us. In terms of CPU cores, so one of the things that I'll talk about maybe a little bit later is I'm not thrilled because you can have like 100 CPU cores. I'm not sure it's going to use many more than 4 because a bunch of the components here seem to be single threaded. In terms of the RAM, I don't actually think you need 8 gigs RAM. Probably 4 is good, but you probably can't get by with like 1. So you can't put this on like a little droplet. Okay. So, how to install? There's kind of two ways that they have to install. The first is manually, which means installing a bunch of components individually. Don't do it. It's just not good for you. By manually components, I mean just setting up the apt repositories and installing them and stuff like that. But there's a bunch of magic that happens under the scenes, and then you spend all of your time trying to like fix little configuration files, and it's kind of gross. The only way that really works consistently is to use this BBB install script. And then if you use this BBB install script, then it will set up the apt repositories, install the software, set up the configuration files with your IP address, set up Let's Encrypt, set up Greenlight, and then everything will just kind of work. So their promise is that you can get up a big blue button server using this script in half an hour. I don't actually believe that. I think Mikolai believes that because he did that. But I didn't. Now, of course, this is a script. So this is like, take this script and run as root off the internet. And so you probably actually want to look at what's in the script beforehand. I looked in the script and it was kind of okay. I tried to install it manually at first and it did not work out that well. And then I ended up giving up and just using the script. There's a lot of comments here in the chat. So 4 dedicated virtual cores in a VM. Yeah, I think that you need 4 dedicated virtual cores in a VM if you want to try it. At least that's what they're saying. Okay, so that's how you install it. I'm not going to go through all of the steps that you do to install things and configure things. One of the nice things about the project is that the documentation is actually fairly thorough and it's more than moderately correct. So if you're actually looking for how to solve something, docs.bigbluebutton.org is one of the best places you can find it. And you're all good at reading, and so you can follow those instructions. Let's say that you have an installation and you want to upgrade it. Basically, what you have to do is an apt upgrade, because they publish these Debian packages or Ubuntu packages, and they will upgrade themselves, and then a BBB conf restart. But be careful, because there are things that can and will break if you actually customize anything. And I'll talk about that a little bit later. Okay. So let's go into the stuff that I really like about Big Blue Button, and then that might be followed by some stuff that I really don't like about Big Blue Button. So the good things in terms of features, it's basically feature parity with, you know, a lot of these other web platforms. It does a lot of things that, and it does, furthermore, not just does them, but it seems to do them fairly smoothly. So in terms of Zoom and its 40-minute limits, there's no limits when you install your own server. You can be there for 17 hours a day if you want. The audio is there. One of the things you can see, my name is nice and highlighted here because I'm talking. When there's 4 or 5 people talking, you can actually see their names up at the top, and you can see who's doing talking. And it turns out that's actually really handy when you're doing kind of an audio conference replacement. Shared presentations and shared video links. So it's very easy to take a video URL and then stick for one of the common hosting services. YouTube works, I think Vimeo works, and there's a few others. And then what will happen is that on everybody's screen, it should just kind of start playing the video in synchrony. So if you guys want to have your meeting where you are making Mystery Science Theater comments, on Mystery Science Theater type comments on your videos, then you can totally do that. And I have cheap and expensive. So cheap basically means it doesn't take a lot of bandwidth and it's not streaming a lot of stuff. So shared presentations and video links, basically on any kind of computer that can run the HTML client, you can use those. Webcams and screen sharing are expensive in the sense that the Big Blue Button server is streaming a bunch of things for you. And it's actually kind of bad, because for webcams, let's say you have 10 people who are all sharing their webcams, then the Big Blue Button server is sending 10 streams to each of those clients. So that can kind of get expensive. And then we saw with screen sharing in 2 meetings ago that also gets expensive. So one person will display the screen and then it gets streamed out to every single person. There's chats, shared notes, there's whiteboards. So you can see my little red dot, and I mean, you can make it a multi-user whiteboard so that everybody can have a dot and can highlight and underline things. You can record and playback meetings, although there's some caveats with that. Breakout rooms, so if you're actually doing a seminar in class and you want everybody to break up in groups of three, you can totally do that. And that seems to work okay. Phone bridge capability. So this isn't by default, but you can make it so that you can make a VoIP call and then people who do not have good access to the internet can actually phone in and they can at least get the audio. There's other things too. So Colin was mentioning WCAG, so the accessibility things, and that reminded me there is actually functionality here for closed captioning. This software is supposedly good for it's supposedly good for accessibility as well. So those are the nice features that I like, and they mostly work. Other things that I like, so I don't know if you've ever been Zoom bombed. I've been Zoom bombed, and it's not very nice, and so there's a bunch of moderation things here. Oh, Mikolai says the expensive parts will be expensive with any solution. I'm actually not convinced about that, Mikolai. So one of the things is whether you mix all of the video and then just send out one stream to everybody, or if you just take in 10 streams and pass out 10 streams. And so for audio, it takes in all of the streams and passes out one stream. So that's relatively low bandwidth, but it's also just audio. For video, it's actually just relaying everything over. So moderation functionality, I really like this. So there's passcodes on room, and you can change them mid-presentation. In fact, that's what I did. So I screwed up the meeting code because I'm dyslexic or something and can't tell the difference between 3 and 2. And so I just took that off. I went into the green big blue button interface, the green light interface, I should say, and I just took off the passcode. And then you can change the passcode. So since, let's say that there's some jerks like macOS users who are breaking into your Linux user group and you don't want to make sure that they get out and stay out, then you just kick them off and then you change the passcode and you don't tell them what it is. There's this idea of called a presenter. So that's the person who can kind of control the whiteboard and control where the presentation is. And there's one person who gets that. So that's kind of the talking stick. There's this idea of moderators versus users. So there's squares. So Andrew and I are squares. And not only are we squares, but we're moderators. So we can do things like we can force mute people on the mic. We can lock users, lock down functionality. We can make it so that, so right now we have it so that nobody can use a webcam, because why would you need a webcam? But we can also do things like lock out chat. We can prevent people from sharing audio, things like that. So if you're having a really rowdy bunch of students, then you can lock them down so they can, the best they can do is they can join your room maybe, and they can just listen to what you're saying, but they can't actually be disruptive. There's also waiting room functionality where people can't join until you've approved them in the waiting room. I don't think that that's so useful in the sense that you can't actually talk to them before you let them in. So either you recognize the name and you let them in, or you don't recognize the name and you take a chance. So Ron says, I'm locked. What does that mean in the big blue button context? So what that means is that I've put restrictions on regular users so that they can't do everything that big blue button allows. In particular, I've locked it so that you can't share your webcam, but I could lock other things, and I can lock things in the middle of the presentation. So if I wanted to stop everybody from being able to type in the chat so that I could get on with things, I'm joking. But if I wanted to do that, I could totally do that. Right? User restrictions in a free software group. Well, we have permissions, right? We have file permissions, so it's the same thing. So let me temporarily do this. So let's say apply. And now I just disabled private and public chat, and now nobody can chat. You're all silenced. Andrew can. Well, okay, because Andrew's a square, but I could demote Andrew. And now he can't do that. So you have a lot of power as a moderator, and you can really control things. Obviously, you don't want to abuse that, but it's helpful if you have a large group. Okay, so the other thing that I like, or another thing I should say that I like, is flexibility. So some of the things that I like is that you can use it for a bunch of things. So you can use it for its original purpose, which is like an online classroom, and that seems to work pretty well. We use it for our ad hoc meetings, like our IT meetings, we can do it, and you can set up the rooms so that anybody can start a particular room, and you don't, and everybody is a moderator, and that's pretty good. I would still put a passcode on that, but that's good if you want to have like meeting spaces. So instead of having a little conference room where people go out and have a meeting, you can just set up these rooms and have, and everybody can go in, and then you won't have this moderator listener thing. Being the staff at TWC, yes. Is there a raise hand functionality to selectively enable somebody in a classroom setting? Yes, there is. In fact, Bob has made himself a little happy face, and that is, those are icons for people raising their hands. So it looks like Raul has raised his hand, and so I can say, Raul, you can unmute your mic and you can say things, or you can just do things in the chat. Replacement for phone conferences, I talked about that. Group video chat, that works pretty well. You can have a grid of people all sharing their webcam if you have the bandwidth. Remote help, so the person you're helping can share their screen and you can both see what's going on, or the remote person could share their screen and edit a Word document and you could both work it on. The thing that you're missing there is you don't get remote control. So you kind of just have to describe, no, the button to the left at the bottom. That's the sort of thing you have to do. And if you want to do Mystery Science Theater movie parties, then you can totally do that just by sharing YouTube videos or something. Okay. So I like that it's flexible and it works pretty well for all of these things, even though it's meant to be just online classroom software. In terms of user experience, one of the best things, and this is new, it only came with the HTML5 client, you can just use your browser and it will just kind of work. So you don't have to install a Zoom app. You don't have to worry about the jerks in your IT department who put software restriction policies that don't let end users install their own stuff. It'll just kind of work as long as they have something like Firefox or Chromium. Other browsers will work, like Chromium-based browsers will work. Safari kind of works. Edge kind of works, but not well. Internet Explorer doesn't work. Lynx probably does not work, but a lot of common browsers work, and they mostly work pretty well. The HTML client mostly works in terms of having a good user interface. I've worked with this with many people who do not have strong computer skills. I have to usually say, oh, look at the button that looks like a microphone and click that, or click the big blue plus button at the bottom, but they're able to figure out the interface pretty well. Raul says, I love the echo test, and I also love the echo test because it means that, you know, you're not joining the meeting and saying, hello, can somebody hear me, with everybody else hearing you. You can take your time and do that. People have used this on phones and on tablets. It seems to work pretty well. Obviously, on a phone display, you lose a lot of, like, you lose some of the ability to see what's going on. But it works fairly well, and people have worked with it successfully on both. So I'm pretty happy with that. So in terms of being able to get in and actually use the thing, even if they don't have a lot of technology skill or experience, they're usually able to do it. And so that's important to me in my context. Bob says, and yet the audio caused me trouble when I was connected, even though the echo test was okay. It shouldn't be happening too much on this server, but there have been hiccups, like this hiccup that John Steele noticed, where he was just getting the spinny arrows instead of seeing call on screen. That does happen sometimes. And so what I do is I will not disconnect from the entire session, but there's a settings menu at the top, the three vertical dots, and then you can go into settings, and in data savings you can turn off your screen sharing and then turn on your screen sharing, and then suddenly screen sharing works again. So, you know. Okay, one of the other things that I like a lot about this is that even if you have a bad computer, you can still participate in some ways. Obviously, it's not as nice as having a fast computer and being able to see everything, but there's some nice ways to to gracefully degrade. So if you don't have a microphone, you can just listen in. If you don't have any audio and your audio is not working and we have the phone bridge, then you can phone in and you can use the phone to actually talk, and then you can use the HTML5 client to see what's going on. And that's a thing that a lot of people use. Slow computer. So on my netbook, I'm able to listen to meetings in the listen mode. I can't use the microphone because then my computer crashes. If I have bad internet, which I do here, then I can turn off screen sharing and then I save bandwidth, and it seems to work pretty well. In my experience, which may not be true anymore, this client seems more lightweight than Jitsi or Zoom or Microsoft Teams or any of the other ones that I've been using. We did a little test with Jitsi, and at that time it was really bad on Firefox, as we learned, but it was fine on Chromium. I think that Jitsi is getting better, and probably a lot of these other ones are getting better, but I think that overall BigBlueButton is still more lightweight. I think that the free switch, audio switch, seems to have a lot to do with really good low latency audio quality. Local apps often have more advantages over a web app, at least for Zoom and Teams. Yes, this is definitely the case. Zoom works pretty terribly in the browser. It can be used in the browser, but it will work very well on a desktop app. With this, it's basically the same. There is no desktop app, so everything works pretty well, or it works pretty badly. Okay. I accidentally disconnected my audio but couldn't find a way of turning it back on. The way you turn it back on, there's this thing that looks like a telephone receiver. Most of you are too young to know what a telephone receiver looks like. But if you click it, you can leave the audio, and then if you click it again, you can rejoin the audio. And that's a way, if you're just listening but you want to have on microphone, you can leave the audio, rejoin it with your mic, and then you're there. So that is one of the things that's a little bit more confusing. Teams, Chris says, Teams cause my fan to run when I run it for work, even if it's not in a meeting. Oh, that's very sad. At least somebody's getting some exercise in this lockdown. That icon disappeared when I clicked it. You should be able to click it again. Yeah. So, in terms of community, the documentation, as I said, is pretty good. The developers are reasonably friendly, but they're kind of overwhelmed, so they're not responding to as much as they got swamped as soon as we all went into lockdown as well, because everybody suddenly remembered Raoul's presentation and wanted to install BigBlueButton for themselves. But they're pretty friendly, which is much more than I can say for the people at FreeSwitch. The support channels are okay. The best support channel is probably the Google group, which is proprietary groups. And then in addition to that, thorough documentation, and then also maybe the issues queue. And I really like that they are actually committed to a fully open source software platform. I'm kind of getting sickened by, I'm getting tired of the community core stuff, but oh well. Okay, so what do I not like so much? What is the bad? So, there's a lot of pieces smooshed together, and that's fine, but the code is not packaged that well, and there's a lot of issues. The biggest issue, I think, is that, so it comes in Debian packages, and Debian packages are fine. Debian packages have this thing that says you can mark configuration files, so if you upgrade your software, it will be careful about not blowing away your configuration files. There's a bunch of configuration files in BigBlueButton that are not marked as configuration files. So you do an upgrade, and then all of your customizations go away. So you really need some kind of configuration management or script so you keep those things if you are doing any customizations. Package dependencies have this problem. There's this thing called BBB demo, which is actually the thing that you will see when you go into test.bigbluebutton.org. I don't want that, and you shouldn't have that in production, so you try and get rid of it. Well, first of all, it's got a dependency on Tomcat, and Tomcat is actually not just an essential for the demo, but for the entire thing, so then BigBlueButton breaks. And then the other thing is that every time you want to upgrade, it kind of sometimes wants to come back, and that sucks. There's a lot of these organically growing things. There's a lot of different kinds of languages. Like there's JVM stuff, and then there's Meteor, and then there's Ruby on Rails. And does it all need to have that stuff? Some things depend on Docker, and some things don't. this green light thing that's in Ruby on Rails depends on Docker, and unlike Colin, who loves Docker, I hate Docker. It causes me nothing but problems, and it kind of makes me grumpy that I can't just install an Ubuntu package and have this Ruby on Rails app working, but I guess that's not how you do things in 2020. There is a testing methodology, supposedly. I don't love, like, the testing methodology is supposedly there, and there's like Travis files and stuff, but some of them have been disabled. They say that they work really, really hard to test this thoroughly, and I believe them, but I don't know how they do it. And so I worry sometimes about regressions and stuff like that. So I don't know. So I don't think that the code quality is super fantastic, but I'm and I'm sure that if you looked under the hood at the source code of Zoom, or you looked at the source code of Microsoft Teams or whatever, it would be fantastic and pristine. But sometimes I get a little bit worried about the code quality here. Oh, and then there's security. So here's the biggest thing that kind of sucks. It's based on 1604. So they've the Big Blue Button people have decided we are going to support one distribution and one version, and the distribution they chose is Ubuntu. That's fine with me. I use Ubuntu all the time. The version they chose is 1604, which is still kind of in support, at least the core parts are. But not every component that's used in Big Blue Button might be in core 5-year support, so that worries me. And oh, they're going to release their next version, and they're going to finally upgrade, and they're going to upgrade to 1804 instead of 2004. And so I'm not terribly happy with that. I wish they would just skip the version and then be on supported software. So I do worry a little bit about security in that sense. The Greenlight front end would allow you to get in and like start meetings and things like that, and I would like to lock that down, and I haven't found a good way of doing it. We all yelled at Zoom because they weren't end-to-end encrypted, and boy howdy is Big Blue Button not end-to-end encrypted. You have to be kind of careful to make sure that even your audio streams and your HTML5 client are encrypted. Let's Encrypt helps a lot with this, but if for some reason you can't directly access Let's Encrypt, then you have to go through a lot of work, and everything is just plain text on the hard drive, which, as we see, is going to be in the next point, is a big issue. So right now we have this little red record button that you might see at the top. That means we're recording. But even if that button is off, we're still recording. For some reason, in the HTML5 client, it just always wants to record. So on this hard drive, there's going to be all kinds of private confidential information and video and audio that's just there, just in case. And I hate that. And so on our server at work, I've just disabled recordings entirely, which you can do, but then nobody can record anything. There have been some security issues that have been reported, and they've been pretty good about patching them, so that's pretty good. But I don't know that there's been a lot of, scrutiny on the code base, and I'm sure that there are still some security issues. You also have to open up a lot of ports in order to run this thing, because it's using RTP streams and stuff, and so I don't know how much I trust the security overall. I think it's okay, and I think that within the app it's pretty good, because the aforementioned snot monsters, if there's one thing that children love to do, it's break things. So I think as they've used it in classrooms, they've probably found a bunch of ways that kids can break things, and they've patched those things. But you know, I don't know that I love the security some of the security aspects of it. Some irritations. So those access codes are always random 6-digit strings, and I can't like set them, so I couldn't actually fix this the 6-digit code. I had to either get rid of it or generate a completely new one. So it would be nice if I could put like readable codes, like you know Linux sucks instead of like 32364, but that's a minor thing. Recording playback is weird. So you can playback and record, you can play back your recordings. Anonymous users shouldn't be able to do this, so you'd need a Greenlight account in order to do that, which is kind of sucky. But the way that it does it, it doesn't actually generate a movie file. What it does is it kind of uses this weird timeline thing where it notes where in the audio the slides have changed, and then it displays those slides. So that's kind of weird. Fortunately, Andrew found this BBB download thing, and what that will do is that will convert your thing to a movie file. So that's good. The HTML5 interface is pretty good, but it does need some explaining. I had to write some documentation for my users in order for them to know how to do things like upload a presentation, this thing about like changing your settings, and even the fact that the settings menu is just three little dots, and what do those three little dots mean? The URLs are ugly. The actual URL for this meeting is something like webconference.kwlug.org/b/paw-something-something-something-something-something. So I used Nginx aliases to fix that, so that if you go to webconference.kwlug.org/room/kwlug, then that will just do a redirect to the ugly alias. It's usable. It's not like a UUID or something like that, so you could read out the ugly alias to somebody on the phone, but it's not that nice if you're trying to advertise the meeting. I prefer having readable rooms if you can. Missing features. So you can't do remote desktop control. That sucks. It's not so easy to stream. So if you wanted to stream to YouTube or something like that, then I don't know how to do it. But Mikolai has figured out what he does is he records this with OBS, and then he can stream out to YouTube that way, so that you could have tens of thousands of users, and Google could have all of your content. And then, you know, there's other sorts of missing things that I find myself missing. Mostly I'm okay with it. But another thing maybe I'm missing is the ability to make easy ad hoc rooms. Really what you need to do is you need to make rooms, you need to pre-populate the rooms, and then people can go to them. It's not like Jitsi Meet where you can just make a room on the fly. That's not a thing that really can be done here. Bob asks, can somebody do a presentation on OBS? I bet you somebody can. Oh, look, and that person is typing. So that's going to happen next month. Okay, another thing I don't like is scalability. So in our context, it's not that bad in terms of numbers of people, but it looks like there's a maximum of about 100 concurrent participants on the server. So not just in one classroom, but on the server overall. If you have more than 100 people going, then there's some limitation, node.js or something, or free switch or something, that just makes everything not work. So they say you can't go really over 100. Some processes seem to be single threaded, and so they'll just tie up an entire CPU thread. Gordon says they had a limit of 200 participants. Yeah. So I think some of that may depend a little bit upon what the clients are doing, but I think some of that is just the CPU, the bottlenecks on the actual server. Video scales quadratically. So that's the thing where if you have 10 people on webcam, then it's sending out 100 streams, not just 10 streams, because it's sending out 10 streams to each participant. So that sucks. Audio is better. And then the bandwidth is a place that's really burned us. So in terms of scalability, it's okay for most small things. I think if you're doing a really, really big presentation, what you do is you'd maybe have this kind of meeting like this with a smaller group, and then you'd put it out to like Icecast or, you know, YouTube Live or something like that. And then millions of people could see it. So that's the way that, which conference was it? The FSF conference that we went to. That's the way they did it, and I think that would work pretty well. Andrew says, I wonder how bandwidth compares with Jitsi. I bet you audio is worse than Jitsi. I don't know about video. I think that somebody, Hubert, on the mailing list was saying that they are actually going to mix and just release one video stream instead of having 10 video streams for 10 webcams, so that would be better. You can, however, when you're doing webcams, you can set the quality of the webcam as well. So you can do that on a server level. And there's also an option when you share a webcam, it allows you to choose one of four different settings. And the server administrator can customize and set what those settings are. So if you want to reduce bandwidth a little bit, you can. But I think as the number of participants goes up, then this gets really bad. okay, ugly. And these are the things that are kind of deal breakers. The biggest deal breaker the first biggest deal breaker has to do with NAT. So NAT is when you put, is you have a Rogers connection or something, and then Rogers has a public IP, and then you have your network behind it, and there's some magic that happens so that all the computers in the network can go and connect out to servers on the internet and get the right responses back. And that's network address translation, and Big Blue Button hates it. It really wants to be its own server on the internet with its own IP. It does not want to be behind a NAT router. And guess what I tried to do at work? I had a 20 megabit up Rogers connection, and I tried to put it behind a NAT router, and I could make it work sort of, but then there was a deal breaker. So the way to sort of make it work, you have to hack BBB install, because it checks to make sure that your IP is the same, and it's going to get an internal IP, and that's going to fail. And then you have to actually put in your public IP into several places in order to make things work. And that kind of sucks. And then if your IP address ever changes, you have to change those conf files. So you're basically looking at writing a script or configuration management or something to do. And the third thing that a lot of people have been struggling with, it's hard to get it working behind the network and in front of the network. Chris is telling us to use IPv6, and I'm going to skip that suggestion right now. Would DNS mask on a NAT router fix that problem? No, that would not. Is this for the same for Jitsi? I don't think so, but I don't know. So the basic issue with NAT overall is that it's trivial to go, if you're behind a NAT router, it's trivial to go out and make an outgoing connection to a server, right? And that part kind of works, and that part kind of works even with your NAT. So everybody is able to connect to the HTML5 client, and that works out pretty well. The thing that does not work very well is the audio and the video, especially the audio, because in order the audio work, the server kind of wants to make connections back to you, and that's the and it wants to do it over a bunch of different ports because it's using RTP, and that's the part that really breaks. And that's where I get to the worst thing that I've run into in terms of Big Blue Button. Not everybody can connect to the audio, and so basically the fault isn't. It's partially that the server is behind the NAT, in the sense that if you take the server and put it on a real IP, then those problems go away. But it's also that certain clients, the way they have their routers set up, they use something called symmetric NAT. I don't even know what symmetric NAT is, but I think it has something to do with port randomization. So you make an outgoing connection, and then there's another random point that goes in and out. So I probably have that wrong a little bit. I thought I understood what was going on, but now I don't think I do. But in any case, I do know how to cause it. If you're using pfSense, which is a router I like very well, and you use automatic outbound NAT, which is the default, then it randomizes the ports, and then nobody can connect to audio. So you can fix that if you go to the client and you say, hey, can you change to manual outbound NAT? And that's reasonable for nerds who run pfSense, but there's other people who don't run pfSense but still have this problem, and it's unreasonable to expect the clients to fix this. So there are workarounds. The one workaround that you can do is you can use a turn server, and basically what that does is that relays all of your audio and video through a third server, and that gets expensive in terms of bandwidth. There's supposed to be a middle ground, which is a stun server, and what that allows you to do is you tell the stun server your IP, and the server and the Big Blue Button server tells the Sun server its IP, and it just brokers a connection. And that's supposed to work, but it doesn't work with symmetric NAT. And it turns out that there's some bugs in Big Blue Button that mean that even if you have stun servers and turn servers, the way it's supposed to work is it's supposed to first try and make a direct connection, then use a stun server, which is cheap, and then use a turn server. But instead, it will just try and make a direct connection, try and use a stun server, it doesn't work, and then it just fails. Or you can say no stun servers, then it'll try and make a direct connection, fails, and uses a turn server, but it'll do that for everybody, even people who don't need it. So that kind of sucks. So that's a big limitation, and what that means is that sometimes we're having problems with people connecting to audio, and so what we say is just use the phone bridge, and then they use the phone bridge, and then it kind of works. So people will call in to use the phone to actually have the audio, and then they'll connect to the HTML5 client to actually see what's going on the screen. and that kind of works, but it requires you to have a phone bridge, and it's not that nice. It breaks the easiness of having just a big blue button. Okay. Troubleshooting. So if you ever want to do this, then I have learned the hard way that there are some places that you should look at. So I was having all kinds of problems with connecting to audio, and that's a thing called WebRTC. And so the places to look for things like that is in Firefox. You go to About colon WebRTC, and that shows you the connections it's trying to making. And also, if you press F12 and go to the Web Developer Console, then it will show you what the HTML5 client is trying to do, because it logs verbosely there. And so you can actually see what it's trying to do, and that's very helpful. Chrome has exactly the same sorts of things. Well, not exactly. It has slightly different sorts of things, but I don't remember what those, how to get into those things. You can look them up yourself. Free switch, I've had all kinds of audio problems. And so looking at the free switch logs, but also looking at this FSCLI thing. And the FSCLI is some kind of command line client, and that'll show you what's happening as it scrolls by. And then in Big Blue Button itself, there's this bbbconf command, which is what you use to restart and look at the status and stuff. And so /--debug and --check are actually very helpful for seeing if you've got your ports right and things like that. There's other sorts of ways to troubleshoot, but these were the ones that I thought were not necessarily immediately obvious to people, and not immediately obvious when I was reading the documentation. Okay, helpful resources. This is if you're going to download the slides. docs.bigbluebutton.org, the Big Blue Button Setup Google Group. Searching that is very helpful. There's a lot of people who ask the same questions over and over again. The issues, and then I also put my customizations. I wrote them in a configuration management, and then I just kind of threw them up on GitHub. It's not drag and drop. It's more of a study resource than it is something that you just run, but it can show you some of the places where you want might want to make customizations. And so you can go there if you're so inclined. I'm not that happy with what I've put up there. I was trying to use it to customize this server, and I was running into some problems, but it's still useful maybe as a way to, as another source of information about where and why you might customize things. So let's finish the story with some misadventures. At work, Big Blue Button was mostly a flop. The audio problems were a big barrier. I showed Big Blue Button to a bunch of people at work, a bunch of different groups that I thought might benefit from it. There was a little bit of uptake, but not very much. And they basically purchased a Zoom license and were done with it. So I think that at work, it's not going to be used very much. We're still using it a little bit in our IT department. I'm using it a little bit to troubleshoot as a poor man's team viewer. But other than that, I don't think it's been very good. And being behind in that has been a big problem. For KW Lug, I don't know, maybe you guys all hate this and want us to go to Zoom. You can put that in the chat. But KW Lug does that. Drupal is using it. The Unix users group is doing it. Mikolai ran his Flatten the Curve conference on Big Blue Button, on this very Big Blue Button. So that was kind of interesting. Data City uses so after Mikolai proposed Big Blue Button to Data City, they got really excited, and then it suddenly appeared on their webpage that they were offering video conferencing, and it very much looks like they're just offering their own Big Blue Button instance, so that's pretty good. Other than that, I don't think I've put out to other user groups that, hey, you can use this. Like if you were having a Fair Vote Canada meeting and you wanted to like use something like this, then people are welcome to do that sort of thing. I haven't had much adoption. I've put it out on a few places, but I haven't put it out widely. If you have a user group, it doesn't have to be a technical user group, but some, you know, a knitting group or something like that, your macrame group, and you all wanted to meet, then you would be able to do that on this server. I'm pretty open about it as long as there's somebody responsible who can open and start the meetings. June says no sound. I don't know what that means. Some alternatives, let's say that you hate Big Blue Button. Jitsi, I think, is the big player in the open source space, and I think it's getting better and is probably going to be the one that wins. Not too many people know about Big Blue Button. They did not see Raoul's presentation. That's the problem. There's this other one called Open Meetings, which is kind of a competitor. It's kind of similar in that it's just a bunch of things mushed together, and it's not obsolete. They just had a release a little while ago. They are flash-based, though. There's this thing called Wire, which I don't know too much about, but I think I hate because it is one of these open core things. They were made by the people who made Skype, or some of the people who made Skype. They are open source, but it's really hard to figure out how you actually do anything. And then there's this thing that's interesting enough to mention, which I think Cranky put a message on the mailing list for five different ways to connect with open source and use video conferencing. And P2P chat was interesting because it doesn't require a server, supposedly. So I haven't used it, but it would be a thing, like if you really want to do something without having to have your own AWS instance or server in the cloud or server, then and this might be a thing to do. Okay, Wire is a hog. I don't know. It might be a hog. So conclusions, it works pretty well if you have the right resources. If you don't have the right resources, you're in a world of pain. And I think it's a very good thing that there's an alternative to Zoom and to Jitsi and things like that. I'm glad that this exists, and I'm glad that we're able to work with it. I don't think it's even that good. Like, let's say that Jitsi was the only open source thing out there. I still don't think that that's so great. So that's what I had for my presentation. It's 9:02. I can take any questions or comments if you want to hang around. And if you don't want to hang around because it's 9:02, then by all means, we can adjourn the meeting. So Ron says that Jitsi's gotten much better audio and video with 11 participants. So that's good. And there's a Linux desktop app, so that's good. Chatborg is WebRTC. All of these things are WebRTC, actually, Bob. Anything that's going over the browser is WebRTC. Incidentally, all the privacy zealots hate WebRTC, precisely because of stun and chat, stun and turn and things like that. You're leaking information about what your actual IP is. So all the people who are on Tor say, never ever use WebRTC and turn it off. Are we going to the bar after? I think that's up to you. I don't know that anybody at the bar is going to be serving you, but you might. Jason says that he was on a Jitsi meeting with over 20 people and it was flawless, so that's good. I think Jitsi's not bad. It's when I was testing it, we were having very bad experiences, but I think that like Big Blue Button, they've been overwhelmed with interest because of this lockdown, and so I think there's been a lot of attention going to all of these projects to try and make them better. So I have hope for it. Colin wants to make masks, and if anybody wants to collaborate on that via the KWLUG Big Blue Button, so that would be great. Colin, you can contact me about when you want to meet, and I can make you a room and an account, and we can set you up on the Big Blue Button if you want. How easy is it to set up a Jitsi server? I am not sure. Ron asks, is this Big Blue Button hosted on Bare Metal? Yes. So Data City gave us a server. I don't know how much RAM is in there. Mikolai would know. It's got lots of bandwidth, and so it's working okay. Joan is going to make masks. Okay. Can you have Big Blue Button conferences running simultaneously? Yes, you can. The overall limit of 100 users or maybe 200 users still applies. But you can totally have multiple rooms running at once, and I've done that. Other questions? Has anybody here heard how Data City's thing is going? I wonder if they consider it successful. I do not know. Mikolai would know. He's the one who's got the connections there. What can you expect with a DSL link of 28 megabits or 8 megabits on a BBB server, audio Visio for say 20 users? So I think that for 8 megabits up, that's going to be your bottleneck. You can do audio. You can do slides the way that I've done it. You can do video, and that's what you can do. You probably can't do very much with webcams. You might be able to do screen sharing for small groups. For 20 users, you might be cutting it close, but if you're like just sharing a terminal window, you can probably do that. If you're sharing a giant screen, then it might not. Okay, what is UUG all about? That's the Unix users group. They are much older than KWLUG. They meet at a bar one Wednesday a month, except that they're not meeting at a bar either. They are people who talk about Unix and or maybe gossip. So I don't know too much about what they do. I've never gone to one meeting, but I've heard that they're pretty intense. Some people go. Yeah, Jeff goes. Jeff is going to answer our question. Lots of gossip, some Unix, says Jeff. Jason asks, if you mention you love just systemd, will you get kicked out? Just kidding. You might not be kidding. But, kw.net if you want to join UUG. Great. Okay. So I'm happy to take questions if people want. I realize I'm sorry, I went over time. I'm the one who's always yelling at people that they have to keep their things at 40 minutes, and I didn't keep mine at. But if you have other questions or conversation or something like that, I'm happy to stick around for a bit. Not too long, but, you know, till 9:30. And then other than that, I think we're done for this month. We are really desperately looking for presentations. So it looks like we have next month, July, and half of August, but it would be really great to get some more presentations in the queue. Who knows how long we're going to be doing this online. I'm guessing we should just plan on doing things online until we believe that people are allowed to congregate and spread viruses to each other again. D2L might use, I'm pretty sure, so if you, so Andrew says DTL might use BBB. I'm pretty sure they did. So I went on YouTube and I looked at some of the videos that Desire to Learn is showing for how to use their virtual classroom, and it is big blue button underneath. What's the CPU utilization on the server for RAM and commit? It's not bad. Let's see, do I still have the server open? Right now, we are using, so FreeSwitch is using one CPU at about 94%, so it's the biggest thing. In terms of RAM usage, it's saying it's using 5 gigs. I think that a bunch of that is not that much. But it's overall CPU usage for, I guess, all of the cores, top is reporting 0.8% usage, so it's not that bad on the server. And then in terms of bandwidth right now, it's not bad. It's like 2 to 3 megabits per second, something like that. But again, this is without webcams. Yeah, it's not bad. So FreeSwitch is pretty good on bandwidth. And other than that, it's just serving up the client. So it's not that much. It's really pretty good if you're not using webcams and you're not using screen sharing. So we can all turn on our webcams for the bar portion of KWLUG, maybe. Webcams are overrated, I would agree with that. Yeah. Yeah. Ron says he hopes for webcams. I would probably look at reducing the definitions, the video definitions that people are allowed to use for webcams. Yeah, so in one of the configuration files, you can actually set what those different resolutions are. I did not end up changing them.
Thank you for listening to the Kitchener-Waterloo Linux User Group audio podcast. Our monthly meetings are free of charge and open to all, so please join us if you are around. We meet on the first non-holiday Monday of each month from 7 to 9 p.m. in Kitchener. Please visit kwlug.org for upcoming topics, for directions, and for additional meeting information. In addition to attending a meeting, you can participate in the KWLUG community by joining our email discussion list, by offering to present a topic, or just by spreading the word about this podcast. Thanks also to IndieServe Networks, archive.org, and CCJ Clearline for hosting our website and multimedia files, to the Working Center for offering meeting space, and to the many people who participate in the KWLUG community. Until next time, goodbye world.